On this episode of Skeptico, Dr. Massimo Pigliucci discusses his new book, Nonsense on Stilts, and how to tell science from bunk.
The large majority of near-death experience researchers who've really published in this field are in consensus.
Alex, that's like saying that the vast majority of astrologers are in agreement with the fact that astrology works.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, I have an interview with someone who was suggested to me by you, folks who listen to Skeptico. And I always like to accommodate those requests. You guys have some great recommendations. Unfortunately, I'm just not able to get to all of them. We actually have a thread on the forum with a lot of recommendations. I try and get to as many as I can. But I do have an interview today with just such a recommendation. It's Dr. Massimo Pigliucci, who's written a book entitled Nonsense on Stilts, How to Tell Science from Bunk. So it's an interesting dialogue. We get into some exchanges that I think you'll find very interesting, no matter which side of this skeptic versus believer equation you're on. So let's get right to the interview. Today we welcome someone who, let me get this straight, has three PhDs, is that right?
That's correct.
So Dr. Massimo Pigliucci is a professor of philosophy at the City University of New York. He's a well-known thinker and writer in the skeptical community, and he's also the author of several books, including his latest that we're going to talk about today, entitled Nonsense on Stilts, How to Tell Science from Bunk. Dr. Pigliucci, welcome to Skeptico.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks so much for joining me. You know, it was I got my hands on your book, and it was really interesting. I mean, I experienced the full range of reactions reading it. At times, I found myself in total agreement with you. Certainly, what this show has been all about is finding the data and trying to find the scientific data and follow it wherever it leads, even if it's unconventional in its direction. But I also found myself, I guess, sometimes at odds with both your interpretation of science methods and what science is revealing. And so while I was reading your book, Nonsense on Stilts, I kept coming back to a quote, a comment from a recent guest of ours, Dr. Peter Bancel, who's an experimental physicist in France and is a collaborator on the Global Consciousness Project. So what I'd like to do to kick things off, if this is okay, is I'd like to play you this clip from Dr. Bancel, which I think we'll really frame up this discussion and then get your reaction, if that's okay.
Sounds good.
The skeptical approach is interesting, but it's, to my mind, it's not science. I mean, skeptics are basically concerned that somebody is wrong in their thinking and that thinking should be corrected. And so skeptics are worried about sort of convincing people that they're wrong or something like that. So it has to do with a sort of a, you know, sort of a social question. I mean, science is something else. Science is, doesn't really, I mean, to my mind, it doesn't really even take a skeptical stance. It's just trying to ask the best questions that you can and then devise the best experiments to address those questions simply because, you know, you're curious about how things are going on in the world.
Okay, so any thoughts on that?
Well, yes, I think he's right on the first point. He's not right on the second point. So he says that skepticism is not science. That's correct. In fact, I am about to go in a month or so, a month and a half, to the amazing meeting in Las Vegas, which is organized by the James Randi Foundation. And I fully expect to upset several people there because my presentation will be about how skeptics are not scientists and therefore they shouldn't really pass judgment on issues that are that for which the scientific community has reached a consensus. For instance, let me give you an example. Several skeptics, including, surprisingly, James Randi himself, as well as, of course, most famously, Penn and Teller, are skeptical of the notion of climate change and, you know, global warming. Well, and I'm sorry, but that's not their place. They're not climate scientists. They know nothing about climate science. And frankly, they don't have the expertise to pass judgment. That doesn't mean, of course, that science is always right or the experts are always right by far. In fact, in my book, there's an entire chapter about the long history of blunders in science. So I'm certainly not suggesting that science is infallible or anything like that. But I am saying that unless you actually have technical expertise in matters of science, your job should not be to sort of be skeptical of notions such as, climate change or the fact that the AIDS is caused by HIV, or the fact that there's no connection between autism and vaccines and so on and so forth. So I do agree with your previous guest that skepticism is not science. Skepticism is a movement that deals with public understanding of science. I mean, the point of skeptics is to increase further public understanding of science by explaining to the general public the difference between science and bunk. It is not to criticize science itself, because science itself already has a very well-established set of procedures for how to criticize its own ideas. I mean, it's called the peer review process. So on that one, I agree.
But hold on. Well, okay, I'm sorry. Then go ahead and address the second.
Yeah, let me make quickly the second point, and then we can have a discussion about it. So the second point that you guys made was that science doesn't even take a skeptical stance. That I don't think is correct. In fact, the history of science shows that more often than not, the scientists tend to be conservative in their acceptance of new theories and new notions. That is, the typical response of a scientist to a new theory is, I don't think so, or I don't believe it, or show me the data, or, you know, let me see why you think that is the case. Which, of course, is a quintessential skeptical stance. And frankly, I think that's for good reasons. Science is a well-established set of procedures, and it has produced a well-established body of knowledge. So any new theory, any new notion, especially if it is contrary to what science has accepted up to that point, ought to be received, and is in fact received by scientists with skepticism. That doesn't mean that scientists don't change their mind. That doesn't mean the new theories are not eventually accepted, if in fact they're good theory, they're sound theories. But the initial reaction is always one of when you write a scientific paper, which I've done several times in my career as a scientist before becoming a philosopher. When you write a scientific paper, the first thing that the editor does of the journal where you submit the paper does is to send it to two or three or four people to criticize it. You know, the first reaction is one of skepticism. People want to make sure that what you write is sound, that it makes sense, that is based on, that your conclusions are congruent with the data that you have, and so on and so forth. So I disagree that the stance of science is not one of skepticism. Of course it is. But it is of skepticism in the positive sense. It's not skepticism in the sense of, I don't believe it no matter what. It's skepticism in the sense of, okay, well, let's see what your claim is, and if the evidence that you put forth is proportional to the claim.
Right. And without degrading into a total discussion about semantics, what I found totally delightful about Dr. Bansell's comment is, I think it reframes what you're saying in a more positive light, in that, yes, science is a method. It's not a position. And I think he puts that out first and foremost and says, let's always remember it's about the method. And therefore, being skeptical, this agitation kind of stance that we think of, it isn't necessary, I think, what he's saying. What he's saying is just ask good scientific questions, ask them in a way that are testable inside of an experimental framework, and voila, you have good science. And I agree with that, and I take it one step further and maybe ask you, don't you see that perhaps there's a fundamental problem when we start throwing around terms like bunk and pseudoscience? And let me refine that a little bit, if I will, and give you an example. I mean, you know, a few years ago when the Korean stem cell researcher, Han Woo-suk, I had to look up his name, but anyways, he came out and he had fabricated his data, right? So he created all this data to get the result he wanted, and he posted it. Now that's bunk. Or an example I've used on this show before is Sigmund Freud, a pillar in our scientific community. But when you look at what he did, it was bunk. He created these cases that didn't really exist and then published them like real data. Now, that's bunk. But when we venture into some of these other areas where there's different opinions, where people are struggling to trying to figure out the science, can we really, don't we have to be careful when we throw around terms like pseudoscience and bunk? I mean, I run into that all the time with parapsychology and other controversial science where people are throwing out these terms and they just don't know what they're talking about. They're not grounded in the research. They're just grounded in a position. Here's my position is that mind equals brain. So anything that contradicts that, well, I don't even have to really look at the science behind it. I know it's false. It's bunk. It's pseudoscience.
Right. So you make some interesting points, but let me make a few comments. First of all, the case of the Korean research in on stem cells, it's actually not even bunk. It's just fraud, right? I mean, had the results been real, meaning you know they would have been in fact science, not bunk. That would have been perfectly good science.
But he did have some good science, right? I mean, he's a good researcher. He just stretched. So
he made up stuff. So that's fraud. And there are very very good procedures within the scientific community to punish people, you know, scientists who engage in fraud, in fraudulent, you know, production of data. I mean, the papers are publicly, you know, retracted by the journals. There is an international system of censure and so on and so forth. So I wouldn't call that example bunk because had it been genuine data, that would have been perfectly fine science. That would have been simply making a perfectly normal, contribution to the way we understand that the biology of stem cells. What happened instead is that those researchers just made up stuff. In which case, and you know that happens from time to time. So I would consider that fraud. Now let's go to Freud. Freud is not exactly pseudoscience either. This was a classic case that was treated by Karl Popper, who was the philosopher of science, who originally came up with the idea of what I called in the book, the demarcation problem. Right, the demarcation problem is how do you tell science from non-science? And Popper did was to take some examples of what he considered, absolutely solid science. And the best one that he could come up with was Einstein's theory of relativity, which had been spectacularly confirmed very recently when Popper was writing, and to compare that to examples of clear non-science. And one of his examples was, in fact, Freudian psychoanalysis. But what he said about Freud was that it's not a question of whether Freud was right or wrong. It's a question of how do we know whether he was right or wrong. And Popper's point is that we can't know because pretty much every human behavior is explainable one way or another by psychoanalytic theory. And Popper's point is, you know, if a theory is that flexible, that no matter what the data are, it can explain them, then there is no way in principle even to falsify the theory, to show that the theory is wrong if it is in fact wrong. And a theory that cannot be falsified, it's not science. If there is no way to tell whether a theory is right or wrong, because the theory explains everything that gets thrown its way, then it's not science. That doesn't mean it's pseudoscience. That doesn't even mean it's wrong. It just means that we cannot know, and therefore we cannot think of it as science. Now let me get to your third example, which is paranormal.
Well, hold on. Let me just interject there because I agree with you, and I think that's a great point. I love the way you pulled it out. In Freud's case, as we found out later, probably later after Popper wrote that, is that there was actually fraud involved. I mean, he didn't really have those patients. He was manufacturing. The theory was his theory, whether that was real science or not. But the data that he used to support it wasn't real data. So you kind of have both.
I'm not sure about that point. I don't know enough about the history of psychoanalysis to actually confirm that.
Yeah, that's
that.
A fact.
Well, if it is, then it's a matter of fraud. And it falls into the same in the first example before. Now, but there is no reason why the theory itself has to be discarded just because a particular practitioner engaged in fraud. I mean, that's the same for as far as, you know, research on stem cells. You know, it's not that like we shouldn't do stem cells research or that there's something wrong with the biology of that research just because that particular Korean group of researchers engaged in fraud. So there's a distinction we need to be making between individual instances of researchers who commit fraud. Those obviously should be discarded as such. You know, if you make up stuff, then it's obviously this is not science. But a distinction needs to be made between that and the possible value of the theory itself. And my point was therefore broader about Freudian psychoanalysis. The idea is that it's not a scientific theory, period. No matter, even if the data are correct, even when the data are right, even when you can bring up case histories, you know, documented case histories and all that, the theory still is not science because it cannot be falsified. Now let's go to your third example, which is paranormal research, and you know you're right. A lot of people do throw around terms like bunk a little too easily. In fact, if you check out in the book, there's a chapter where I talk about paranormal research and ufology, for instance, you know, UFOs and things like that. I actually do criticize some alleged skeptics or what I call armchair skeptics, who come up with explanations. And the case that I get into in some detail is a particular instance of alleged flying saucers being observed. And, you know, a couple of skeptics just reacted when they were asked by the media, coming up with explanations basically out of thin air and for what the alleged flying saucer was. And it turns out that those explanations were, in fact, wrong. There was a natural explanation for the sighting, but it wasn't the one that the skeptics were providing. So that's an example of a skeptic being close-minded because, you know, they simply knew that it couldn't possibly be in flying saucers. And so they came up with the first explanation that came to their mind without bothering to checking whether the explanation actually fit the data. That's not good skepticism. That is not the kind of thing that we need to do. On the other hand, you know, research on the paranormal has been done for almost a century. I mean, we have done plenty of experiments, say, on telepathy or clairvoyance or things like that, and we know it doesn't work. So how many more times do we have to show that?
That's just not true.
Of course it is.
And you know what? No, here, I'll tell you what. That's going to launch us into, I think, the other part of this discussion, which I think is interesting, because talking about philosophy of science and skepticism is interesting, and it provides some grounding, and I like a lot of the points that goped out there. And I think that's useful in the book. But it does seem, and I expressed this in the email to you, you know, it's only when you really dig into it that you really have a grip on this. And I think, for me, you get to the real challenges of this skepticism and bunking and pseudoscience. And so what I'd pull us back to, and I sent you this in the email, is a post that you wrote in October 17th of 2006 about out-of-body experiences.
Yes.
So this is something that we've dug into more on this show, so I can at least know a little bit something about, unlike some of the other topics you talk about where I'll just be out in the weeds. But in this post, here is the comment that you make that I just find incredibly troubling. You know, you talk about the Nature article and Olaf Blank's research, and then you say, this is good stuff. That should take care of the whole paranormal mumbo-jumbo about out-of-body experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's your quote.
I stand by that quote, yes.
It's astounding. I mean, to me, it seems incredibly, well, it seems unscientific. I mean, here you have this phenomena, out-of-body experience. Mm-hmm. It's widely reported. It's very perplexing. It's very much unexplained, especially since the largest number of the cases reported happens at times when we can presume that there's no electrical activity in the brain. That is, people are flatlined, and that's when they're having OBEs. So that's the situation. And then you have this research come along, and it produces the effect that's similar, but everyone agrees, hey, this isn't really a full-blown out-of-body experience. It's not a lucid experience. It's hallucinatory. It's not a full-body experience. All these things that we normally see in out-of-body experience.
But out-of-body experiences are hallucinatory. That's the point.
Well, no, they're really not if you research them as they're most encountered in the near-death experience research.
Right, I know.
And what the near-death experience research finds conclusively over and over in studies is that they're non-hallucinatory.
You mean to say that there is actually research that shows that people get out of their bodies?
All this research is descriptive, right?
Right.
So Olaf Blank just asks people about their experience. And if you look at that research, when they're reporting on their out-of-body experience, they say, my arms were shorter than they were. They were out of proportion. They were in this way, that way. Those are clearly hallucinatory.
Right.
That's not how their body really is.
Right.
It's exactly the opposite in near-death experience. They don't see things hallucinatory. They're realistic.
They may be realistic, but that doesn't mean that they're real. I mean, you know, we have plenty of...
But hold on.
Yes.
Hold on. Here's the point.
Yes.
The point is that you have this one study. He didn't even really look at near-death experience. He just speculated that this might have some similarities. I would add that the study was not replicable. Right, there's a researcher in Sweden who tried to replicate the experiment. To this day, no one has really replicated Blank's work. But you jump on it and say, this should take care of the whole paranormal mumbo-jumbo. I mean, we have some real science here to unravel.
Actually, we don't.
Like,
I mean, there's been a lot of research done on so-called out-of-body experiences. And we know that's the article that I cite there, it's only one piece of evidence that the paranormal so-called explanation is, in fact, not an explanation at all. There's plenty of research that has been done on out-of-body experiences. We know that they can be caused by certain physical chemical conditions in the brain. We know that they're essentially, you know, the best explanation, the best explanation for what's going on is that these are, in fact, hallucinatory experiences that are caused by certain replicable, by the way, chemical, physical characteristic, you know, situations of the brain.
Okay, what research are you citing? What research?
Well, I can give you the list on when we got off the air. But that the problem is,
I just got done with that same kind of conversation with Dr. Stephen Novella. And
right. Yeah, he's a good source on that.
Yes. Well, I just got done interviewing him, and he came to the same point. There's a bunch out there, and he never followed through. So I don't know if you're talking about Persinger. Michael Persinger
is certainly one of those. Yes, absolutely. But
I don't think we've had him on the show. I don't think his research at all is conclusive in that way. He hasn't worked with near-death experience researchers, and when he has, it hasn't been an experience that they say matches up to their experience. So,
my point is, you or whoever is making points of, you know, paranormal explanation for near-death experiences is an extraordinary claim. We do have alternative explanations which are much more naturalistic and much more rational for those experiences. It seems to me that, of course, again, science is not the it's not about ultimate truth. It's about provisional conclusions. But from everything that I read of that literature, it seems to me that the naturalistic explanation is by far the most likely. Now, if you want to make the case that no, it's not, and there is something else, it seems that that is an extraordinary claim. And as Carl Sagan famously put it, well, that requires extraordinary evidence. Besides, what kind of explanation is there really? Is you know, paranormal explanations don't seem to me explanations at all. There's no mechanism that is being proposed. There's no understanding of how these kind of things happen. That's not science.
Wow, that's going to really launch us off in a couple of different areas.
Go ahead.
First of all, you know, the other researchers, and that's all we can do is balance all the research out there. The folks that we've had on this show, and one of the people I'd point to is Dr. Peter Fenech, you know, one of the most highly regarded neuropsychiatrist in the world, practicing in the UK for many, many years. And he was on and spoke quite, I think, authoritatively about the out-of-body experience research, about Blank's research, about Persinger's research. And he finds it interesting, but not at all compelling in the way that you do. The same with the other folks that I've had on. Dr. Jeffrey Long has written extensively and published peer-reviewed articles about the very marked differences between Blank's out-of-body experience that he encounters and those that he's encountered in near-death experience. So I don't think it's at all to the point where we can say this whole paranormal mumbo-jumbo stuff should go away. And I think that's part of the problem. When you get into
Alex, I'm sorry. Let me stop you there for a second. But if we're going to play the expert, you know, the expert game, it's too easy. In fact, that's one of the things that I get into in the book. For any position, almost for any position whatsoever, no matter how far out it is, you will find somebody with a PhD or an MD that is willing to defend that position. But that's not the way science works. I mean, you can find scientists who deny climate change. You can find scientists who deny evolution. You can find scientists...
But Massimo, in this case, it's the opposite of what you're talking about.
No, it isn't.
Because, let me finish my point before you disagree. The large majority of near-death experience researchers who've really published in this field are in consensus.
Alex, that's like saying that the vast majority of astrologers are in agreement with the fact that astrology works.
That's an outrageous statement.
Well,
how can you claim it is? How can you claim? Have you even read? Do you know these people's qualifications? Do you know their published work? You're lumping them all together and calling them astrologers. I mean, where do you come off saying that? What? Again, Blank, the guy that you're referencing, he's not a bad guy, but he's never studied near-death experience. And even since his publication, he's even come out and said, I think the phenomena is still real and not totally explained by the
Alex,
just the
neural Alex,
mechanics.
There's a distinction between saying that a phenomenon is real. I don't doubt that the phenomenon is real. No neuroscientist doubts the phenomenon is real. That's one thing on which we agree. I would also agree that we don't have complete understanding of the phenomenon itself. That doesn't bother me either, because we don't have complete understanding of many more mundane things that the brain does, let alone how the brain reacts under unusual conditions. There is a huge gulf, however, between that and saying that these people are actually having some kind of supernormal, paranormal, or supernatural experience. That's a huge.
But I didn't even get there.
I know you didn't, that's the idea.
Because you threw all these researchers into the category of astrologers. I mean, when you talk about, this whole point is, how do we separate science from bunk? And I'm talking to
Alex. Let me be more clear about what I said or what I meant to say. If somebody who does near-death experience research claims that what these people are doing is having a supernatural experience, that's not different. That's not science. It's not science because, first of all, science cannot actually say anything about the supernatural to begin with. That's not what science does.
By definition.
Yes, by definition. By epistemological, if you want to be technical, it's by epistemological agreement in philosophy of science. No philosopher of science would agree that science has anything to say about the supernatural for a variety of reasons that we can get into if you want.
That gets into semantics.
No, it's not semantics. Epistemology is not semantics. Epistemology is a serious branch. Let me finish for a second. Yeah. It's a serious branch of philosophy that deals with how do we know things, right? And since science is been well understood over the last several decades in philosophy as a particular kind of activity which is based on a particular set of assumptions about what is being studied, one of those assumptions is the regularity of the laws of nature. If the laws of nature study behavior erratically or in a way that is completely unpredictable, you wouldn't be able to do science. Now, the supernatural, by definition, doesn't have to be bound by natural laws, obviously. Otherwise, it wouldn't be supernatural. Which means that, in fact, epistemologically, science has reaches its limit there. There is nothing sensible that a scientist can say about the supernatural. And therefore, if a scientist claims, invokes a supernatural explanation for a particular phenomenon, that scientist right there has ceased to do science.
Well, but who are we talking about here?
I don't know. Who are we talking about? We're talking about people who suggest that there are supernatural or paranormal implications into these kind of experiences.
But I didn't bring that up. You're arguing kind of against yourself. I brought up Dr.
Well, I like to do that because I always win that way.
Yeah, fair enough. But I brought up Dr. Peter Fenech. I brought up Dr. Jeffrey Long.
Let's not talk about individuals. Let's talk about explanations. What is it that these people think is going on?
Well, let me finish my darn sentence here.
Okay.
The theory is that consciousness, in some way we don't totally understand, survives bodily death. Now, that's well constructed. It's not totally framed up in scientific terms, but it's an important theory because it contradicts the prevailing materialistic explanation of consciousness, which is pretty much non-existent because consciousness is something we're grabbing at. So to say that consciousness in some way we don't understand seems to survive bodily death, I don't know why that violates some sacred creed of science. I don't think it does.
It's not a matter of violating sacred creed. Science doesn't have any sacred creeds. It has assumptions, as I said, but those are not sacred. Even those are not sacred. Let's analyze what you just said. You said something like, this is a theory of consciousness or a theory of survival of consciousness beyond the physical brain that we don't completely understand. Is that you said something on those lines?
Hold it. I'd interject. We do not understand consciousness. I mean, no one understands consciousness.
No. I'm not referring to consciousness. I'm referring to you're saying that these people are putting forth a theory, something on the lines of an incomplete or not yet completely formed theory of survival of consciousness beyond the brain, the physical brain. Is that correct?
No. Well, hold it. We have to step back and say we're trying to get our arms around consciousness, whether it's material or immaterial, what it is, when it begins.
Right. We do have quite a bit of knowledge about consciousness. I mean, I would certainly agree that the problem of consciousness is far from being solved. But it's not that we don't know anything about it, right?
Right. We can always say we know something about it, but fundamentally, we don't understand its nature, whether it's material or immaterial, whether there's a cause and effect, free will.
Actually, we do. In philosophy,
Let me finish. We don't know what entities or beings are conscious. We don't know. We think dogs and gorillas are conscious because when they look at themselves in the mirror, they identify themselves. We think other animals have some other limited form of consciousness.
Well, it makes perfect sense.
Let me finish. We don't know if computers can be conscious or if that's or what's
necessary.
Don't
they are not. We know that they're not. We know that they're not.
Okay. We know that they're not. Right. So the point being that anyone who speculates about the end of consciousness is only speculating. Even if we get down to hard-nosed medical terms, we're really less and less sure about what death actually means. And, you know, I just heard Dr. Sam Parnia, who's explored this probably more than anyone in terms of resuscitation and what our definition of death really means. So to then, in that larger context, for someone to explore one aspect of that and saying, I'm going to explore the end of consciousness and whether consciousness can survive bodily death, and then present the findings of the phenomena that they observe is that in some way from the research that we've done, consciousness seems to survive bodily death. I'd frame it up.
First of all, it doesn't, because even if I grant you that there is something about what you're saying to these experiences, these are not people who actually died and came back. These are, by definition, near-death experiences. So it still doesn't establish anything at all about consciousness surviving after death. We've never had an example in history of somebody who was actually certifiably dead and his consciousness has survived.
See, now hold on, because right there, Dr. Parnia would strongly disagree with you. And the best research on this is...
Yeah, like what? Give me an example.
Okay, first of all, his definition of death, which is as good as I've heard, is to say, to look at cardiac arrest patients and to know that when someone has a cardiac arrest, like this is not a heart attack, this is cardiac arrest, your heart has stopped. We know within 10 to 15 seconds, your brain stops. We know that if we do nothing, you're dead. So his comment is that that person, by any means that we normally talk about it, is dead. That person is dead. So any experience that they have that we can tie to happening after that period of cardiac arrest is unexplainable with conventional medicine.
As the good doctor should know, there is actually quite a bit of disagreement about where exactly the line of certain death is. Cardiac arrest is certainly one of the criteria. Certainly brain activity is another one of those criteria. The two don't necessarily go together. As you pointed out, there is a delay between one and the other. But the point is, before I accept the very extraordinary notion that consciousness can survive death, I want to make sure that somebody's absolutely and completely dead. I don't know of any example, unless you obviously believe in the story of resurrection of Jesus, of any example at all in which we actually have a documented instance of somebody who was dead by anybody's independent observer understanding of death, and then it came back. We just don't have it.
Well, the best research that we do have, or one of the best pieces of research, was done by Dr. Penny Sartori, who did a prospective study of people who had cardiac arrest in the hospital and then asked them to recount their resuscitation process. So this is after they've had cardiac arrest. How were they resuscitated?
Right.
And what she found was in the two groups she looked at, one group that had near-death experiences, the other group that didn't, the group that had near-death experiences were dramatically more accurate in recounting their resuscitation. Now, this is the kind of evidence that we normally accept. We normally say that's suggestive of the hypothesis. And what you seem to have done, and I would say, getting back to this extraordinary claims, extraordinary proof thing, although people who listen to this show regularly will cringe at me going in, launching to this topic again, I don't think that comes into play. I mean, that's fine for the general public to say, hey, you need extraordinary proof before you believe anything. But other than that, scientists have built in, they've internalized extraordinary claims, extraordinary proof. That's how the peer review process works. That's how people are accepted or promoted inside of science, by offering extraordinary proof or making extraordinary claims. So we can't apply that layer on top of things as an observer, like you said, like an armchair scientist saying, wait, that's an extraordinary claim. By whose means do we determine what's extraordinary? That's the whole purpose of science, is to remove us from the bias and prejudices that we feel in making these kind of subjective evaluations.
No, I think that that we have a different understanding of science and how it works. The standard of extraordinary of let me put it another way. Let's get away from the standard phrase, the Carl Sagan phrase. Let me put it in a more rigorous framework, which in fact I try to do in one of the chapters in the book. One of the most widely accepted ways in both sort of theoretical science and philosophy of science these days of thinking about the relationship between claims and evidence is the Bayesian framework. So Bayes' theorem, which is very widespread in statistical analysis, decision making theory, and so on and so forth, and it's now being used in several other areas of science. It's actually a very simple theorem in probability research, probability theory, and it essentially is explains what is the relationship between degree or strength of belief in a particular notion, whatever the notion is, a hypothesis, for instance, a particular scientific hypothesis, and the evidence that is available. And the Bayesian framework not only tells you what the relationship is between belief and evidence, it also tells you what is the rational way of changing your belief when the evidence changes. Because one of the things we need to take into account, of course, that the evidence does change over time. Science proceeds not just because people have new ideas, but also because new data come in, new facts come in that need to be explained by either the old hypothesis or by new hypothesis. Now, if we adopt a Bayesian framework, all that it says is it rigorously quantifies the older idea that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. In fact, the Bayesian framework says that the claims have to be proportional to the evidence. And what I'm saying is that in this particular case, I just don't see from my reading of the literature that the claims are even close to be proportional to the evidence. The claim is really extraordinary because we do not have any reason to believe, or any, again, evidence, compelling evidence to believe that consciousness, whatever it is, however it works, survives bodily death.
But I've just cited you several.
I know, and I'm telling you.
You've cited nothing. You've come back with nothing other than to say, it's out there, it's overwhelming, believe me. Give me something to sink my teeth in. Give me the data. And tell me how this new data has informed or changed your view along the lines that you just said. Because what I see, both from what you've written and what you've said here, is just a very dogmatic stance.
First of all, if we want to talk about stands and dogmatism, you haven't actually given me any evidence, as I'm sure you realize. You just threw in a couple of names there. If we wanted to have this as a serious discussion, then we should email each other whatever references we feel are compelling, and then each one of us should go to those those references, and then we're going to be talking about actual looking at evidence. The fact that you can throw me a name, I can throw you another name. As I said, ask Steve Novella. You said I asked him. Well, that's as far as I know, he's one of those people that actually know these literatures to a good degree, and he's a medical doctor, incidentally, so he can actually address those issues much better than I can. I'm asking, however, a much more basic question, which is, you know, regardless of which authorities one can cite in favor or against, the neurobiology in general, and biology, in fact, even more fundamentally, and cognitive science, and I would add even, I'm going to throw into the mist also philosophy of mind. All of those fields, the consensus in all of those fields is that there is, in fact, no evidence of decoupling consciousness from physical activities of the brain. That doesn't mean we understand consciousness. It doesn't mean that you know, we have an explanation, good explanation, mechanistic explanation for what's going on. But it is something that philosophers of mind refer to as the no ectoplasm clause. The no ectoplasm clause is the idea that whatever consciousness is, it seems to depend on the brain. If you shut down the brain, it goes away. And if you shut down the brain permanently, it doesn't come back.
If what you're asking for and suggesting, and I'm all for this because I've found in doing this show that really one show is never enough. One show kind of tees up the topics. And as you said, I totally agree with you. And I wasn't trying to ambush you with a bunch of quotes that you and references that you can't respond to off the top of your head, because that doesn't prove anything on my point, on my side, or detract anything from your side. I'm happy to engage in that. I'm happy to send you those references and structure a debate around that topic. Are you open to doing that?
Yeah, although I, as I mentioned a few minutes earlier, I'm not actually the best person to do that. I do believe in expertise. You see, one of the chapters in the book is about expertise.
Well, you can get any experts you want to help you.
As I said,
I'm just saying, are you the guy? Are you willing to step forward and say, I'm certainly not an expert either, so I'm going to be relying on experts to coach me. Are you willing to engage?
Well, instead of doing that, I mean, we can do that if you like, but instead of having two non-experts doing that, why don't you actually ask two experts? Get one of your people, the people that you mentioned before, and get him up against somebody like Steve Novella or Ken Fraser, the editor of Skeptical Inquirer, and see what happens at that point. I mean, those are people who actually, allegedly at least, know the literature. Right?
I'd rather do it with you. You're right here. We've opened up the dialogue. I'd rather see it through, and I'm happy to follow through with that if you are.
Well, but clearly we can't do that today because that would require
space. No. Right. We'll schedule it a month or two out, whatever feels right, and I'll send you the references. And you know what I think would be interesting and stimulating? Along lines of the book, Nonsense on Stilts, I think it's almost like a case study, and we can publish it as we're going, you know, as we're accumulating data, and then we'll kind of cap it up with a discussion about it, and I'm sure there'll be
stuff, and we can talk about it. It seems, however, honestly, a fairly bizarre proposition, because if in the spirit of Nonsense and Stilts, I am suggesting that if the controversy is about expertise, then you have to ask the experts. Now, neither you nor I are experts in this particular area, so it seems like we would be talking about just by quoting secondary sources.
But Dr. Pigley,
is that really a good reason? I mean, a good way to go about it?
But you're the one who wrote this stuff. This stuff should take care of the whole paranormal mumbo jumbo. You're the person who's put themselves out forward with making these things. And you said right after that, I stand by that.
Alex, then there's no contradiction between the two statements. And it seems to be clear to me that there shouldn't be any contradiction. I am also say, let me give you another example that is exactly on similar lines. In the book, as you know, I take a strong stance in favor of the notion of climate change. But I don't do that on the basis of my understanding of climate science, because I'm not a climatologist. I'm not an atmospheric physicist. What I do is I do what any good skeptics would do. That is, you go to the sources, to the actual experts, you look at what they are saying, you say, well, is there consensus within that community? And if the answer is yes, there is, then the best bet for somebody who does not have technical expertise in that area is to say, look, unless there is, in fact, a controversy within the scientific community, my best bet is to go with the current consensus, of course, with the understanding that every consensus in science is provisional. So where I take stands that are, in fact, based on my own expertise is where my expertise belongs. And that expertise is in evolutionary biology. So if we're talking about evolution versus creationism, we can do, you know, 10 shows on that. I have no trouble with that. Or in philosophy of science, if we're talking about the epistemology of science, if we're talking about the limits and positive aspects of science, we can also do that. For everything else, including what I say in the book, my position is precisely that the best that a non-technical expert can do is to look at the consensus, if there is one, in the relevant community of experts. By the way, before some of your listeners might actually raise these issues, so I'm going to preempt it, if you don't mind. Whenever I say, oh, you should listen to what the experts are saying, I am accused of committing a logical fallacy, which is the argument from authority. And I'd like to clear up what the issue there is, because for a philosopher to be accused of committing a logical fallacy, it's a really ironic thing, and it would certainly be embarrassing if it were true. So the argument from authority, of course, is a fallacy when you use it this way, if you're saying that it necessarily follows from a scientific consensus or from what an authority says, that what that authority says is true. So if I were to say that, you know what, I know for certain that climate change is real. Why? Well, because the experts say so. That would definitely be an example of a logical fallacy. You cannot derive certain knowledge. You cannot derive, consequentially, absolutely certain knowledge from the fact that there is an agreement within a certain community of experts. Because, of course, the history of science shows that the community of experts can be wrong. What I am saying instead is what I think is a very rational and, in fact, even commonsensical position, which is understanding that whatever consensus science reaches is, in fact, provisional. Your best bet as a non-technical expert is to look at whether there is a consensus, and if there is a consensus, go with it. That seems to be, to me, rather uncontroversial. And it seems to me, therefore, as a consequence of the kind of debate that we're having, that with the two of us can have a debate as non-experts. And, we can keep throwing at each other, names and citations. But the fact of the matter is, I am not an expert on consciousness and you're not an expert in cognitive science. So the best...
Hold on, I'll let you go on there for a while. But hold on. You are an expert...
In what?
By virtue of Nonsense on Stilts, in how to tell science from bunk. And you are a guy with 3 PhDs, and I'm a PhD dropout. So I think we ought to be able to at least demonstrate how someone would sort through this material. It doesn't have to be antagonistic. I don't have anything against you. And I think we've had a nice conversation here. And you're obviously a very intelligent guy and a likable guy. I've listened to your podcast.
All right.
But I think it's useful to show how we sort through this stuff and how we throw out certain pieces of information and what information we include. And that's what
sure.
I'm suggesting we do. And I'll be happy to send you that and we'll just see how the process goes. You're not committing yourself to doing anything, but
I understand. I mean, I'm curious to see the material that you send me and I look at it and we can do a follow up. All I'm saying is I don't think that's actually the best way to proceed, but if that's the way you like it, we can do it.
Well, considering I've had on just about every expert I can think of, I mean, I've had Steve Novell on the show. He's not really an expert in near-death experience at all. But I've had on Kevin Nelson, who's a skeptic and has published in near-death experience. I've had on Michael Persinger. I've had on Jeffrey Long. I've had on Peter Fenech. I've had on Penny Sartori. So I've tried to reach out to the experts. I'm not talking to, high level.
Did you ever have him in the context that you're talking about? Because you're essentially suggesting a debate between the two of us. Did you have him in the context of a discussion between a proponent and an opponent of the notion?
Yeah.
And what happened? On the same show, you mean?
What we've done, and it really works better, is threaded shows. So, one person comes on and presents theirs. So I've had, for example, Kevin Nelson come on from University of Kentucky. his theory on near-death experiences, REM intrusion. He came out and presented his, had Dr. Jeffrey Long come on, present a rebuttal.
I understand, but so that's the way usually it's done. But what I'm saying is that, first of all, I guess, you know, this is your show, so you do things as you like. But I'm actually suggesting that that's not the best way to do it, because
I tell you why it is the best, in my opinion. This is totally stylistically show wise, but if you don't, you wind up with, as we naturally do here, because we're both are enthusiastic about the subject and have a lot to say, but you wind up kind of stepping over each other. You can't completely make your points, and it turns into a sound bite, you know. Pro versus con, point versus counterpoint, and I think you lose the real depth.
But that's exactly what you're suggesting the two of us would do.
Well, I think we can do it in a different way. I think there's a number of different ways to do it, and I'm totally open to doing it in that way where I give you a total free rein to speak, or what I'll probably do is present a case, you know, I'll kind of make my pitch out there and then leave that out there and then invite you to, you can do it on your podcast if you like. You can present your rebuttal and then we can kind of go from there.
That's definitely a possibility. Anyway, so should we move on to another topic or?
Well, I think.
I mean, or, I don't know. I mean, we can stay on this for a few more minutes, but it seems like it kind of beat that horse.
I would love to. And there's many, many other topics I would love to talk about. I do feel like we've kind of used up a lot of your time. We're at 52 minutes here in the conversation.
Yes.
Let me ask you, as we begin to wrap things up, how things are going with Nonsense on Stilts. Obviously, it's a book that's getting some attention and seems to be reviewed well. How is it going for you?
It's going all right. It's an interesting reception. You know, so there's, for instance, a very positive review in The New Scientist, and then there's a very negative review in The Chronicle of Higher Education, which turned out to be written by somebody who is a professor of philosophy, I think at the University of Pennsylvania, and who really, really disliked it. And it was interesting the reason he disliked it. He thought that I was a science warrior, as he put it. In other words, one of these scientifically oriented people who just is, you know, a close-minded defender of science. And the funny thing is that people on the other side of the debate accuse me of not being enough of a defender of science. My colleague, right. Jerry Coyne, for instance, at the University of Chicago, constantly says that I'm an accommodationist and that I'm sort of, in other words, a fluffy thinking kind of guy who doesn't take enough of a stand. So I find it amusing that some of the reactions are, oh, this guy is too much of a strong defender of science, and some of the other reactions on the other side are, well, this guy is not defending science enough. I would like to draw the conclusion that I'm doing something right if I'm managing to piss off both sides of the debate, but that may not be the case. I mean, I don't know. It's been an interesting experience from that perspective, and you know, we'll see how the book is going to be doing over the next few weeks and months. It was certainly a lot of fun to write. I learned a lot about topics that I knew only, you know, superficially or cursorily about it. It took some time to put something like this together, obviously, as you might imagine. I definitely enjoy talking to people about these topics because it turns out that every time that I have this kind of conversation, you know, I've been on several podcasts, I've been on a couple of NPR shows and so on. Every time that I have a conversation, it's a different conversation. It's really interesting because people seem to be picking on different chapters of the book or different themes of the book. And that makes for, you know, I don't want to say endless variety of conversations because, of course, it's a finite one, but it's a really interesting and varied set of conversations. So I'm really enjoying the opportunity to talk about it.
Great. Well, I think it's obviously an incredibly important and timely topic in terms of just science in general. And I think where we go with the gap that we have in scientific knowledge and how that's being treated in our society. And I think you try your best to address it. It's very interesting. I also have to say that I did find, in listening to your podcast, the whole thing on accommodationist and, you know, whether you're a true blue atheist or not kind of thing is, I found very interesting. And I'd love to get into that sometime and talk about, you know, how you can accommodate spiritual beliefs and that, and or whether that's appropriate or how that fits in. Because I think one of the problems, and I think it'll kind of will evolve into that a little bit naturally if we continue this dialogue, because I would submit that one of the problems with near-death experience research is it's under this pale of spirituality that makes it just a hot button issue that folks can't really look clearly and think of and talk about the data because there's this fear that it's going to bring in all these issues of culture war issues in terms of spirituality. So I think the accommodationist thing, and I'd encourage anyone to go, we'll provide links to your podcast as well to go listen to that. I think it's an interesting dialogue.
Yeah, it's definitely been fun. And as I said, I find myself in this bizarre situation where I don't think of myself as either an accommodationist or a new atheist, and which means that I get criticized by both sides. And yeah, it's fun. I can take it. I got enough of a broad shoulder to be able to take that.
Yes, you do. Well, great. And Dr. Pigliucci, thank you very much for joining me today on Skeptico, and look forward to talking to you more.
It was a pleasure.
Thanks again to Dr. Pigliucci for joining me today on Skeptico. Now, I have followed up with Dr. Pigliucci along the lines discussed in this interview. I've sent him links to a couple of papers, and I've also provided those links in the show notes as well. One is a paper I've linked to before by Dr. Bruce Grayson from the University of Virginia, which is really kind of a comprehensive list of all the popular skeptical arguments against near-death experience, and then a reference to all the research that really refutes those. So it's pretty interesting, and I think it's pretty comprehensive. Be interested to see what he has to say about that. And the other is a reference, of course, to Dr. Jeffrey Long, who's been on the show several times. So that should get the ball rolling, and we'll see if Dr. Pigliucci can tell science from bunk and what his opinion is on that. And of course, I'll keep you updated on any feedback we do get. Along those same lines, I have heard a little bit from Dr. Stephen Novella, who is another skeptic who is willing to engage in a dialogue about near-death experience and was on the show, but hasn't really done the follow-up that we agreed to. So Dr. Novella has said that he is planning on following up on the discussion we had. He's just busy at the moment, so understand that, and we'll keep you updated as we hear from Dr. Novella. Well, that's going to do it for now. Be sure to check out the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com for all our previous shows, an email link to me, a Facebook link to me, and a link to our forums. I do have some interesting interviews coming up on Skeptico, so be sure to listen in, tell your friends, and until next time, bye for now.